So, yeah, go on ahead then. Describe structurally what they're like and how tall they are.
You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez.
This wall is part of the longest peace wall in Belfast. It runs from the Lower Shanklin Falls right up to the slopes of the mountains that you see in the background are the Black Mountain and Divis Mountain.
Noel Large knows this neighborhood and this talk by heart. He was born and raised in Belfast and gives walking tours in his hometown.
I'm from the best part. I'm from God's country, East Belfast.
But this is not your average sightseer's journey.
First of all, of two pedestrian gates.
Noel guides tourists along the miles of giant walls that wind through Belfast's neighborhoods, and to this day, still separate Catholic and Protestant communities.
Built by the British Army in the early to mid-70s, constructed by concrete.
And Noel's no ordinary tour guide. His personal actions decades ago, including murdering several of his Catholic neighbors, are part of the reason these so-called peace walls came to exist in the first place.
I'm a former prisoner. I came out on the Good Friday Agreement in 98.
December marks 100 years since the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty, which led to the creation of an independent Irish Republic and a mini-state known as Northern Ireland. Through the Troubles, the Good Friday Agreement, and now the fallout from Brexit, the partition of the island of Ireland has been tumultuous, and the tumult is far from over. This week on the program, we reckon with that past and try to understand where things may be headed for Northern Ireland. Let's start by getting to know our local tour guide.
Well, my name's Noel Large. I now live in Monkstown, which is a working-class housing estate about 8 or 9 miles out of Belfast on the north side. I moved there when I got out of prison in 1998. Before that, I spent 16 years in prison.
Noel Large grew up in Belfast in the 1960s. Back then, as it is now, as it's been for centuries, the city's been home to two predominant populations. Roman Catholics, sometimes called nationalists or republicans, because they largely wanted to establish a Republic of Ireland apart from the United Kingdom, and Protestants like Noel's family, often called unionists or loyalists, loyal to the British crown, people who wanted to remain British subjects and wanted their part of Ireland to remain in union with Great Britain.
My family were very much Protestant unionist, and my mother's side were loyalist. We were living right beside a nationalist enclave called George Drawn. That's where my first primary school was. We distrusted Catholics, not because I had any contact with them, but because what you learn at your mother's knee. The first contact I had with Catholics was when I was 10. We moved to a brand new housing estate. There were Catholics in the estate, but there were very few. But my first friend was a Catholic, and him and I played football together. But when the Troubles started, by the time 71 came, the Catholics were all put out, maybe 40 families in one or two nights, forced out, pulled to leave, 48 hours, 24 hours. So I called for my mate Tony Robinson to come and play football one day. The next day I called, it was a different family in the house. Never seen him again. And the only difference between Tony and I, his school blazer was St. Augustine. Mine was Dundonald Boys.
Noel's childhood friend was kicked out of the neighborhood during a time commonly referred to as the Troubles. What began as Catholic protests against repression and discrimination turned into decades of conflict that left more than 3,000 people dead. The early days of the Troubles often split up good neighbors and friends like Noel and Tony, and that laid the groundwork for an even deeper cultural divide.
So, growing up, that was the first sort of impact, right? But then the Troubles got worse, and I was able to see and hear bombs going off and was far enough away to be safe, but close enough to see the effect. There's the plumes of smoke, you hear the big bomb. And Bloody Friday had a big impact on me because I lost a friend.
Within the space of half an hour in the middle of the afternoon, no fewer than 20 large bombs exploded in various parts of the city. 11 people were killed and 120 injured, many very seriously. And the damage...
It happened Friday, July 21st, 1972.
Bloody Friday, the IRA in Belfast planted 22 or 23 bombs that were all timed to go off in, say, a period of 1 hour. It was a summer's day. I was 6 miles away. I could hear the bombs go up. I could see the plumes of smoke. So I knew it was bad because I'd seen bombs before, but not going off like this. And then when I watched the news, I learned that one of the guys I went to primary school with was killed in Oxford Street bus station. He was in the parcel office. Car bomb planted outside, blew. But what made it worse was you could see the police, soldiers and ambulance men scraping body parts in the plastic bags with shovels. So that impacted on me. But that distrust of Catholics, it was put in there as a jail. There was no sense joining the police because they were being handcuffed by successive British government's policy of appeasement. The way it was being put across was we're going to have to do the fighting for ourselves. So I joined the UVF as a 17-year-old, joined the youth wing.
UVF stands for Ulster Volunteer Force. It was one of the largest paramilitary groups on the Loyalist side during the Troubles.
I belonged to a unit that was about 6 miles out of the centre of Belfast. There was no Republican or Nationalist area near me. So you weren't joining to take the fight or defend. Basically, all you were doing was weapons training and stuff like that. So it was like you were being trained for what would maybe come further down the line. By the time I was 19 or 20, I had a football injury and my chances of a career in England were zilch because I ruptured my ACL. So by the time I was married and had a baby daughter, around 81, that's when I reinvolved myself with the UVF.
As leaders of Loyalist and Republican political organizations continued to stoke the flames of rage, Noel felt his options narrowing.
I was asked basically what I was prepared to do, and I told them that I didn't fancy being a bomber because I didn't know how to make bombs and I didn't want to carry one. So I became involved in murders, attempted murders, bank robberies and armed robberies, and trying to procure weapons and even teach others in training in weapons. Became very active.
And the main news tonight is the double kidnapping of UDI man Tommy Cochran and West Belfast man Joseph Donegan. And with only a few minutes to go until the UVF deadline and Mr. Donegan's life passes, there's still no word from the gang holding him. Several attempts
on October 24th, 1984, a Loyalist gang kidnapped a Catholic man named Joseph Donegan on the Falls Road, main street of Catholic Belfast. The kidnappers called Noel in to help them finish the job. Donegan was beaten to death, his body dumped in a Belfast alley. Within days, police arrested Noel and the others.
I would have been arrested and held about 4 or 5 times, or up to 7 days at a time. The last time I was arrested was charged with 4 murders and a whole host of offences. Pleaded guilty, received 4 life sentences in 357 years, June 1985. I was 24 when I went to prison, just short of being 25.
Noel Large didn't serve those life sentences. As part of the historic 1998 Good Friday Peace Agreement, more than 400 former militants from both sides of the conflict were freed from prison. It was a controversial move, meant to try and begin to restore 2 broken communities. But for Noel, it was a chance to remake himself.
I grew up in prison, became a man in prison, began to think for myself. By the time the mid-90s came about, I was very much aware that all the violence was doing was creating bigger graveyards and needing bigger prisons. I wanted to come out and make a change where young people were concerned, try to dissuade young people from going down the road that I went down. To me, you didn't have to be a gunman to be a loyalist. I went to college and got certificates in community development, community relations, and I got a job in East Belfast working with young people. And I painted a Titanic mural in East Belfast with young people. And then I got a job here working cross community. And that was the making of me in terms of working at building relationships across the Peace Wall.
The Peace Wall that we're at now, which is at the foot of the Shankill and the foot of the Falls, would be about 40 to 50 feet in height. It's in three sections. The first section would be your concrete slabs. Then you have your palisade fencing, again, metal. And then above that, 15 feet of wire mesh. The wire mesh was added later.
The low-grade civil war between Unionists and Republicans officially ended more than two decades ago. But those sharp community divisions have left a permanent mark on the city's geography. If you visit Belfast today, you can see the peace walls for yourself. They're also called peace lines or simply the interface. Miles of high walls and gates act as barriers between Catholic and Protestant neighborhoods, built to make people on both sides feel safe. And for visitors to Belfast, they've become sort of a tourist attraction. Noel, like some other former prisoners, works as a tour guide at some of the wall's most important destinations.
The first peace walls unofficially would have been burnt out houses where you had both sides living so close to each other. Both sides erected barricades at the start, which would have been burnt out cars, buses, lorries. And then by the time the 69 turned into 70, 71, you had the burnt out houses being bricked up, and then the army coming in with their engineers and taking those houses down and actually erecting what became known as the Peace Wall. Now, people wonder why it's called the Peace Wall, but the people living in the shadow of that wall weren't being given any peace because they were coming home from maybe a day's work, and the house, if it was close enough to the other side, the other community, could have been the target for petrol bombers, people with catapults firing staples to break windows. And they seen the walls as their idea of getting a peaceful night's sleep, even because, you know, they didn't have that peace.
Graffiti on the walls illustrates some of the most important scenes of Belfast's past and present. Newer murals tend to paint over historical divisions and call for peace, unity, and understanding. Older murals tend to commemorate each side's points of view, often depicting paramilitaries, heroes and martyrs, flags or symbols from the conflict.
Part of this wall continues on round to the Nationalist Republican International Peace Wall. Now, what Republicans have done is they have aligned themselves with revolutionary parties all over the world. PLO, Hamas, ADA, groups like that, even FARC in Colombia. And it's like a solidarity. Whereas when you come through the security gate, which is just around the corner from here, you come through the security gate, on the loyalist side, you have the Battle of Britain, Band of Brothers. It's about the RAF, the eagle with the crown above it. And around it you have the airplanes, you have a Spitfire. You have a German bomber. And I think it's quite poignant that you have on this side, our identity sees us clearly as being British because of our war effort, whereas the other side, who see their struggle as a liberation struggle, and they then identify themselves with revolutionary groups.
There are also so-called peace gates, breaks in the walls. They open to allow foot and vehicular traffic and close in times of crisis. Most of the peace gates are also closed every single night.
Like this one that we're standing in front of now, which will open early in the morning, close maybe half 8 at night in the winter, whereas in the summer it'll be open to maybe 10 o'clock. About 100 yards further up, you have another security gate, and then about a quarter of a mile up, you have the main security gate, which would have been used to prevent drive-by shootings, because Lanark Way would have been a drive-by, easy access for gunmen from both sides coming out of one community into the other. So they have, on their gate, they have cameras which take photograph every car's registration. It goes straight to, I think it's Grosvenor Road Police Station.
With cameras pointed both ways, it's a bit like a gated community, bordering another gated community, with one significant difference. The residents on both sides of these gates are not particularly wealthy. In fact, many of the neighborhoods close to the peace walls and peace gates are also communities of social and economic deprivation.
It's not the people who lives at the walls who create any of the trouble. It's the people who come from further out, and they create the trouble. But the people that live here, we started getting them together and worked on interests of common concern. You know what the biggest concern is? Poverty. See the community that lives here and there, especially there, because they're right up against the wall. Long-term unemployment, low educational attainment, low wages, single-parent families, and it's the same on both sides. And there's a guy I do tours with from Notre Dame.
No surprise on these streets, Noel runs into a friend, or at least an acquaintance.
Hello, how are you?
Good morning.
Nice to meet you.
Peter and I do a tour every couple of times a year.
Three times a year for Notre Dame University.
Notre Dame, yeah, okay.
Well, if there's anything he doesn't know, I absolutely know, you know.
Peter McGuire and Noel do a recurring tour for American students from Notre Dame University. In tandem, each takes the lead on a different side of the peace walls.
I give my perspective as a Catholic growing up during the Troubles, and do a tour of the Falls Road and just answer questions, and then Noel takes over and does the same on the other side. Because as you know, there's two sides to every story, and I wanted the students that came over to get a rounded overview. I can certainly tell what my feelings were whenever I was growing up. I would have been sort of diametrically opposed to Noel whenever he was growing up. But I think now Noel and I have struck the perfect balance in giving our point of view and also giving the students who are studying Irish politics over here, I think, a balanced view where they can make their own informed decisions, Noel.
No, when we meet them in the morning, usually about 10 o'clock, and we meet in a hotel in the city centre, and we'll have tea and scones with them, so they get a look at us. But the thing about it is, I like to be on his tour, because it gives me an insight. You know, when you're growing up, all you've got is the news to go on, and the news isn't always the right story. So I enjoy hearing not only his perspective, but his experiences. And then after lunch, we do my side, and we're not trying to score points. We're not trying to go, I was right and he was wrong, or I got it wrong, he got it. It's not like that.
You know, I can't speak from Noel's perspective and he can't speak from mine. Believe it or not, we both tell the truth, you know. Another thing too is that whenever I was growing up, I never in my wildest dreams would have thought that I would ever meet Noel. And in fact, it was, I did as much as I could not to meet Noel whenever I was growing up, if you know what I mean. So for me to be standing on the Shankill Road with Noel, with a group of American students three times a year, and both of us giving our perspective of what happened to us, and you know, the effect that it has had on us, because I've lost family and Noel has lost friends and family. And, you know, that's something that you can't turn a blind eye to. It's always there as part of who you are. But I think the most important thing is that we have reached a stage now where we are, what they say, we're reaping the peace benefit.
If one-time rivals can laugh together, give walking tours of their former battle lines, you might wonder, why are these walls even here? Who needs them anymore?
Well, as somebody who doesn't live next to the wall, but I know people who do, I think the general consensus is, even though we are in a period of peace, which is very, very good, I think a lot of people want to wait and see. It's like a security blanket, if you like, you know, that they're, it would be better if it came down, but I can't see it happening for a while.
The peace walls were never meant to be permanent. I don't think there was any way that the planners could have foreseen that 40-odd years later that they were still there and that they're not coming down in any time in the next couple of years. I think Peter Maguire got it right when he said it's a security blanket, it's like a comfort blanket. You have to remember there's children in their 20s and 30s and 40s who know nothing but the walls. The wall was there before they were there, right? It's not so much that the people living there don't want them down. It's that we need to create an environment where there's confidence enough in both sides to say, if this happened, what would be the outcome? And to say reconciliation, it's not even the proper word, because to reconcile means to get back together after a split. But there was no split. There was no union. There was always a split. So we're never together in the first place. If you took the wall down tomorrow, that doesn't mean that both communities are going to interact a whole lot better, right? So the community where I live in Monkstown, 100% Protestant, there's no wall. No physical wall. But the wall's up there, because if I was to go home tonight and say I'm going to bring 20 Catholic families to live in the estate, it's not going to happen. So there's barriers of the mind, which are every bit as serious to overcome than the walls that you can see. The one thing that's synonymous with them is, on both sides, is desolation. There's never been much of an attempt to actually try to do any investment along the peace walls. And instead they're saying, no, bring the walls down and we'll invest. Whereas I think they've got the cart before the horse. I say, bring an investment, create a feel-good factor, and then people will see the walls as a hindrance.
If economic investment did come to the neighborhoods along Belfast's peace walls, if the status quo in Northern Ireland was ever going to shake up, the next few years might bring the moment. We'll talk about that after the break. A special thanks to producer Don Duncan for additional reporting in Belfast. You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. If you missed any part of this episode or want to catch up on other international stories, you can download our podcast. Just search for World Affairs, that's one word, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Westminster. After decades of fighting and civil insurrection, the Irish were to be granted home rule. Well, most of them anyway. On that December day, the 26 counties in the south became the Irish Free State.
Shortly after the new Irish Free State was established, with much fanfare, it recognized the creation of another mini-state in six northern counties in Ulster province. It was called Northern Ireland, and it turned out to be a dangerous bargain. It split the Irish independence movement and set off a civil war.
I mean, what we ended up with in Ireland was two sectarian states, really. We had a Catholic state in the south and a Protestant state in the north, divided by this crazy line that zigzagged across the country through lakes and bogs and over mountains and through villages.
Journalist Susan McKay experienced that awkward divide while growing up in the border town of Derry, or Londonderry. Today, she believes the conditions may finally be ripe for change. For starters, there's the British departure.
The Brexit minister, Lord Frost, says significant gaps remain with the European Union about customs arrangements in Northern Ireland after talks with his EU counterpart in Brussels. The UK is warning that it could unilaterally suspend parts of the Northern Ireland deal unless major changes are made.
As the United Kingdom struggles to make a deal with the EU on life after Brexit, Northern Ireland is increasingly isolated. There's also a new generation, less attached to the old rival political identities. And there are demographic changes at work too, says Margaret O'Callaghan. She's a senior lecturer in modern Irish politics and history at Queen's University in Belfast.
You know, Northern Ireland was set up primarily to accommodate Northern Irish unionists. If most people in it are no longer unionist, if there are both unionists and nationalists or people who couldn't care less either way in it, it has to find some justification for its way forward.
What might the Irish island look like 100 or even 20 years from now? I dug into that question with Margaret O'Callaghan and Susan McKay a few days before the official 100-year mark of the Anglo-Irish Treaty. Professor O'Callaghan, is the 100th anniversary a cause for celebration or something more like ambivalence?
I think the signing of the treaty is certainly a cause for commemoration, perhaps celebration. I suppose the fact that it led to a civil war in the south means that there's always a kind of question mark over it. The other thing about the Treaty of 1921 is it didn't seem to those who signed it that the partition they partly signed up to would be as permanent as it proved to be.
That boundary created realities on the ground that didn't exist in Irish tradition. Susan McKay, they took a pen and sort of created a hyper-concentration of Protestants in the north. If you just took historic Ulster, it might not have been quite that lopsided, but there was intent around creating a Protestant state, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. I mean, just yesterday I was in a village which is straddled by the border. You just cross the street and you're in a different jurisdiction. So the border is a kind of a mad, invisible line across Ireland. And in many ways, it has disappeared because of the Good Friday Agreement. But in other ways, it persists and has become sort of like a scar that has started to itch again. It's very much something which has come alive again in a way that it had been dormant for quite a long time.
Go ahead, Professor.
You get the drawing of these new boundaries all across Europe after the First World War as the old empires break up. And change in Ireland is in a way a beginning of a breakup for the British Empire. But I suppose what's different about the Irish case is that the lie of the border is based upon no pre-existing division. The kind of language that was used to dress it up internationally was self-determination for Irish unionists. But that doesn't quite work because the lie of the border was so peculiar because it wasn't a pre-existing entity.
Well, the government in London fostered the creation of Northern Ireland, it said, to avoid another war. They were convinced, or so they said, that the Unionists of the North would simply not consent to live in a country run from Dublin by an Irish Parliament elected island-wide. Strictly speaking, was that true? Would there have been a war if not for partition?
Well, leading scholars like Paul Bew would argue that that is the case. I mean, I would take the view that the British line is a little more disingenuous, perhaps, than it sounds on the surface. There was an Irish unionism that, you know, loyal to Britain all over the island of Ireland. Yes, there was a greater concentration in Ulster the use of the language of self-determination was something that the British government got into because it was Woodrow Wilson's international language about the European peace settlement. And the British government were always very worried about US opinion coming up to the end of the war and even after the war. So there's an extent to which an argument for self-determination for loyalists of Ulster is kind of thrown into the mix. But I think it's a slightly disingenuous argument. It's not completely without merit, but it's dubious.
Susan McKay, you wanted to say?
No, I was just going to say that the problem with the border as it was set up was that, for example, I come from the city of Derry in the northwest of Ireland, and it's a border city and a majority Catholic town, which was corralled into the north and simultaneously cut off from its hinterland in Donegal, which remained in the Republic. So Donegal became very isolated and Derry was cut off from its natural economic hinterland. So in many ways, the border wasn't ever going to settle and couldn't really settle because of the discontents that it hemmed in within the Catholic and nationalist communities. So in some ways, the border didn't actually settle until the Good Friday Agreement because, you know, first of all, we had the civil rights movement against the way in which the unionist community had managed to dominate the six counties of Northern Ireland. So that happened in the 60s, and then that was followed by the IRA campaign, which started in the 1970s. So it wasn't really until the Good Friday Agreement that the border was kind of made acceptable to people. I mean, in some ways, partition never really did bed down. I think people in the Republic have maybe made the mistake of thinking that it did, but it really didn't in the North. There was a lot of denial about that, I think, among unionists in the North, but the nationalist community have constantly been discontent with the outcomes of 100 years of partition.
I suppose the territorial parameters of Northern Ireland were created to have the largest amount of territory with the largest possible unionist slash Protestant population. So what you had in the 20s was a 60-30% balance within Northern Ireland. Now, in order to quote unquote control the restless minority, you had kind of gerrymandering, you know, a very heavy state apparatus. I suppose what's changed also is the balance of population has changed dramatically. So now within Northern Ireland, the population's almost 50-50. So the lie of the border was created in order to have the maximum majority of unionists with the smallest possible minority of nationalists. But now time, history and demography has unraveled that, as well as all the other changes that Susan's mentioned, you know, up to and including Brexit.
When I first reported from Ireland before the Good Friday agreements, I was stunned by the number of people I met on both sides of the border, close to the border, who had never been to the other side. You both talked about the border being kind of artificial, about it appearing and then disappearing and then reappearing. Where are we now? Over the 20 years or so, a whole generation, since both countries were in the EU, there was peace on the island, relative peace on the island. Did the place start to knit together in a way that started to make it one place in a way it hadn't been since 1921?
Yes, I think that it did. And I think that what you're describing, that kind of fear of crossing the border that existed, I mean, I think in some ways in the Republic, it was a bit different. People just kind of settled into their own state in the Republic. But in the North, there was a lot more sort of disturbance and fear. I think it's important to think about the border not just as that crazy line, but as a peripheral region, you know, because really the border actually takes up quite a lot of the counties of Ireland. It takes up almost a third of them if you count in the counties on either side of it. And they became marginalised from both the Dublin government and the Belfast government. And there's it's a strikingly poor region even now, you know, and as a result, you know, the crossing of the border, I mean, really people would be thinking in terms of, well, would you go to Belfast? Would you go to Dublin? Because the towns along the border were quite poor and not of particular commercial interest to people for crossing, other than people would cross the border for things like to buy alcohol in Belfast because it was cheaper to buy petrol in the Republic. So there was a certain amount of sort of opportunistic crossing of the border.
Would you say, Susan, after partition as well, railway lines that crossed the border, public transport that lost the across all kinds of former lines of communication kind of froze at the border, which contributed to running down the whole area economically, yeah? And then, of course, Northern Ireland, one of the claims of unionists for why Northern Ireland should be separate and remain part of the UK was its extraordinary industrial success in the late 19th century. And that all went into decline in the 20s and 30s. Now, it boomed a bit during the war, but not since. So there's been a legacy of decline, I suppose, both along the border and around it, yeah?
Yeah, and then when there was a hard security border, a lot of people in the Republic were just afraid of the North. And they were also afraid of it as potentially being trouble that could spread. The notion that the North was toxic and people just kept their distance from it and looked away. And I think there's a lot of resentment still in the, certainly in the nationalist community in the North about that.
Yeah, and the Irish government, I suppose, were afraid that what it would destabilise the whole island. So therefore they spent their time trying to negotiate with the British government and keep on good terms with them at all times, which had all kinds of consequences for how people could think about Irish nationalism historically as well.
Certainly as having been a reporter during the latter years of the Troubles and the years of the peace process, I think that the North is more unsettled at the moment than it has been for many years. Not entirely in a negative way. I mean, I do think that the appetite for peace is very, very strong in both communities, in all communities in Northern Ireland at the moment. And one of the very good legacies of the Good Friday Agreement has been in many ways that the boundaries have begun to break down even between the two communities. I think there's a move away from the notion that we are a binary community. Lots of people are avoiding talking in that way anymore. But what has happened with this centenary and with Brexit and with all of that coinciding has been that there's been a push in unionism to sort of move back to that notion of that we have to reinstate the notion of the North as a unionist state. We can't have it becoming just part of a wider Ireland. Unionism is kind of panicking because the largest unionist party, the Democratic Unionist Party, really, they were very, very militantly pro-Brexit, but I think that they were a bit disingenuous about their reasons for that. I think that they were very militantly pro-Brexit because they actually wanted a hard border back in Ireland. And they saw Brexit as a means to that end, instead of which they've ended up really basically backing the wrong horse in that they backed a prime minister, a future prime minister, Boris Johnson, who went on to shaft them and put a new border in the Irish Sea, which they find symbolically really difficult. So we now have a situation where, as Margaret mentioned, demographics now make it look as if, you know, half the population at least, and certainly in the younger cohorts, is Catholic. And there's an impatience with the kind of terror that unionism has about sharing power in that context. Unionism, for example, has said, we don't really like the idea of there being a first minister who's from Sinn Féin, but that's the terms of the Good Friday Agreement. So there's a sort of impatience among Catholics towards the way that unionism is panicking and huddling together as this kind of binary ethnic group. And there's also a feeling of, well, you know, we've now been brought out of the European Union against our will. Maybe we would be better off in a united Ireland, united within the European Union. So it's not only the militant Republicans who are looking towards wanting a united Ireland. It's also people who felt that Northern Ireland was better off in the European Union.
I suppose there's a deterioration in the relationship between the British and Irish governments, because the Irish government have been trying to make sure that there isn't a hard border on the island, but to do it in the most accommodating way possible. But Boris Johnson hasn't really wanted accommodation because he requires a language of battle with Europe to strengthen him with his own supporters. And of course, ironically, there wasn't a majority for Brexit in Northern Ireland.
This was the first full marching season after Brexit. Was a tense one. Why? What was it about finally being out that made the demonstrations that come in the spring and early summer of Protestant civic organizations so tense this time around? Susan?
Well, I don't think that there was as much tension or trouble about the marching season or that period as has been made out. You know, there was a very small amount of rioting and it took quite a lot of whipping up to get that amount of rioting. And the people who went out rioting were, generally speaking, quite vulnerable young men who were very easily manipulated. And I think that there was a desire by the Democratic Unionist Party to sort of exaggerate the extent of that. I think that really the unionist community is actually relatively calm because the protocol is the deal which the European Union struck to avoid there being a hard border in Ireland. So the protocol is what unionism sees as being the border in the Irish Sea because it creates a distance between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom. But there isn't the anti-protocol feeling that the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, is trying to suggest there is. You know, I think that a majority of people above all just want to keep the peace. You know, increasingly that is being shown by polls, you know, that people are not preoccupied with the protocol in Northern Ireland at the moment. They're preoccupied with the fact that the health service is breaking down, that we don't have a good education system, that people are living in poverty, that we're suffering from austerity cuts being made in London by the Conservative government. So there's a lot of feeling of unhappiness in Northern Ireland, but it's not particularly connected with the constitutional issue, and that concerns unionism because their reason for being is to keep the Northern Irish state separate from the rest of Ireland above all other issues.
I'd like to bring the United States into the conversation because the United States played culturally, politically, a big role in the Irish conversation. And certainly as one of the global homes of the Irish diaspora, the United States has loomed large in the Irish imagination for 150 years. Has the United States been taken out of the equation by the centering of Brexit? Has it really reduced the influence, reduced the input of the United States, which, you know, in the days of Bill Clinton and the Good Friday Accords was a big player? Is it one at all now?
I think the United States is potentially a huge player at the moment. And the reason why it's a player is because the Conservatives, when campaigning for Brexit, kept going on about this enormous trade deals they were going to get internationally. And the trade deal they most wanted was this trade deal with the United States. So effectively, at the moment, the only protection, if you like, internationally that the Republic of Ireland or Ireland has, or one of its protections, is that Boris Johnson is slightly slow to completely dismember the arrangement he's already made because he wants to do a free trade deal with the United States. And he's afraid that Joe Biden may stand between him and that deal if Biden continues to support the Irish position.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that the US and the EU obviously played a huge part in the Good Friday Agreement. And I think that while Trump was president of the US, unionism, the Democratic Unionist Party in particular, many of whose members were vocal supporters of Trump, they felt that America could swing things. Whereas now, I think the fact that Biden has been very clear that he sees himself as being Irish, that he supports the Good Friday Agreement, that he's going to weigh in with the EU in supporting the protection of the Good Friday Agreement, I think that that has made things very, very difficult for Boris Johnson. And it certainly has made unionism fear that they're not going to be as useful to the British government as the British government would have liked them to be in terms of those kind of international deals. I think that political unionism was very shocked by the way that the European Union united behind the Republic of Ireland during the Brexit negotiations. I think that that hadn't been expected. They had had a feeling that it was going to be them and Big Britain, Big Brother Britain, looking after little Northern Ireland against just the Republic of Ireland, and instead of which you saw the European Union and the US actually stepping in and saying, no, actually, we also have a stake in keeping the peace in Ireland by maintaining the Good Friday Agreement. You have to realise that a lot of unionists have become unhappy at the whole way that the Good Friday Agreement has played out. They feel that it has given too much power to the nationalist community. They're not happy with the way that power sharing, and as Margaret mentioned earlier, the fact that the demography has changed, power sharing combined with the fact that there could soon be a Catholic majority, doesn't make unionism feel comfortable. It seems like unionism hasn't been able to accommodate to the idea that there could actually eventually have to be full equality in Northern Ireland. And it's not a comfortable thing to say that, but the evidence would appear to bear that out. There is a kind of unease about the notion that somehow or other Catholics might be getting the upper hand in Northern Ireland, whether that's the intention of the nationalist community or not.
Can the effect of that demographic change be exaggerated? Is it necessarily a cinch, an easily made assumption that once there's a voting majority of Catholics, that big change would come to the province?
I think it can be exaggerated in the sense of thinking that it will lead to a vote for United Ireland in the short term. But it can't be exaggerated in terms of the fact that if you've got a kind of equal balance of population, you can't have what Northern Ireland had been for, which was to advance the position of unionism. If most people aren't highly committed unionists, you have to think conceptually differently about what the society is about. And that is, in a way, what the Good Friday Agreement did. It said, we'll park our wider differences. I can feel Irish in nationality if I want. You can feel British. We can cooperate within this place. We're kind of 50-50. That's the future. And so that was like a kind of open future up to about 2010 or a bit later. Brexit is like a large bollard on the path of that.
Well, Susan MacKay, you can look at a near-term future where nationalist parties start to do better. That could heighten tension, not build it down by creating a more democratic representation of who lives in Northern Ireland.
Well, I think that, you know, most nationalists probably would at this point vote for United Ireland given the chance to do so. Most people in the Republic would vote for United Ireland given the chance to do so. And I think that the task now for nationalists within Northern Ireland is to persuade unionists that they would be better treated in some sort of a new Ireland than they treated Catholics in the Northern Irish state over the last 100 years. And I think that several civic society organisations have been set up to try to start civic conversations about what a new Ireland could look like, and trying to have forums in which people can speak about their aspirations and their fears in a non-threatening way. And I think that the job is now to persuade unionists to feel that there is a worthwhile conversation to be had about a future of Ireland. Because I think that a lot of unionists think of it as being a takeover of the North by the Republic, whereas it actually seems to me that a united Ireland in the contemporary world would be much more a negotiated settlement involving all of the communities, and that it would be a very healthy thing for the Republic of Ireland as well, which isn't a particularly healthy or secure society, you know, to think again about how it's constituted. So personally, I feel that Northern Ireland probably is finished as a state. I'm not sure as a historian how many years Margaret thinks of as being the near future, but I would say within...
I think I'm more sceptical than you.
Yeah, I think within the next 10 to 20 years, there will be some sort of new Ireland, and that the state of Northern Ireland will cease to be, because I think that the way that unionism is behaving at the moment isn't constructive and isn't going to preserve the union. Whereas I think a lot of people from the nationalist community are actually planning for the future, and they're planning for how to get unionism into a conversation about a differently constituted Ireland.
Susan, your new book looks at Northern unionism. What did you decide from those conversations?
Well, I'm talking from my experience in those conversations, really. I mean, I did find that a lot of people were much more open to the prospect of change than you might assume from just listening to unionist politicians. I mean, 50% of the Protestant community don't vote. And a recent poll found that a lot of Protestants have no intention of voting for the unionist parties. A lot of Protestants are now voting for the Alliance Party, which is ecumenical on the constitutional question, so it's open to persuasion one way or the other. A lot of Protestants no longer identify primarily as being unionist. They also don't necessarily identify very strongly according to their Protestant identity. An awful lot of people are talking about, you know, they're in mixed marriages, they're living in mixed situations. They don't feel as staunch as Protestants used to feel in Northern Ireland. So I felt that that was a healthy thing. And I think that people are, they're less afraid than unionism would like us to believe they are. And I think that that's a really good thing. But I definitely feel that there's a lot of wooing to be done by the nationalists and particularly by Republicans. I think that Sinn Féin people, Republican people in Northern Ireland and in the whole of Ireland, don't realise the extent to which people from the Protestant community were deeply, deeply wounded by the IRA campaign and continue to have a great fear and distrust that comes from that. So I think there's a lot of work to be done in building trust. But I do think that there are constructive organisations out there trying to work on that, and that there are people in the Protestant community who will be responsive.
You mentioned the Alliance Party, but there are others, not organized around status questions, but instead organized around an approach to government. You know, so much of Northern Irish politics has been dominated by the what next question, that the parties were all about that. They weren't about, well, should the state continue to support enterprises? How should our educational system be run? The sort of more mundane questions of governance were not the central questions around which some of the most important parties of the North were organized.
Well, I suppose the only parties that fit into that category are Alliance and the Green Party. But Alliance has done very, very well recently, especially with disillusioned unionist voters, and also there's been a shift in mores, I suppose, in Northern Ireland, in attitudes towards gay marriage, for example, in attitudes towards abortion. All of these issues have come up over the last 3 or 4 years and have in fact been legislated for by Westminster. So Northern Ireland, and the other thing about here is a lot of young people go away. It used to be just young unionists who went away to university and didn't come back, but a lot of young nationalists do that as well. So while we have a very young population in our schools, we do have a very high rate of teenage and early 20s migration. And they're the kind of people who build a society, who bring about change, and we probably need to do a lot more to have young people educated here, who stay here and who can change here.
Yeah, I think in answer to that question, I would say that a lot of young people in Northern Ireland now look at the Republic and think the Irish Republic is no longer the Catholic state for the Catholic people, because the Catholic Church has been very, its power has been very much diminished in the Republic, partly because of the scandals that it was engulfed in, and because there have been social movements that have brought about change in the Republic of Ireland. There was a movement for abortion rights, which was very successful. There was a movement for same-sex marriage. There are big movements for Black Lives Matter, climate justice, those kind of issues. And as a result of that, I think young people in the North are looking at the Republic and thinking, well, we could do that up here. The political parties are hopelessly stuck in this politics of orange and green, but there are other ways of looking at how you bring about change. So I think people are looking at the Republic and thinking, things were done there that we could do here without bothering getting caught up in this kind of toxic politics of, you know, that is entirely focused on what happens about the border. So I think there are signs of hope in Northern Ireland.
Well, to close, I'd like you both to look ahead, if you would, to the coming years and what people in the United States should be watching for if they're interested in this story. Is Brexit a catalyst to that next Ireland or an impediment to that next Ireland? Is the relationship between North and South bound to remain fraught as it has been? Or are there big forces pushing them closer together? What do the next several years look like to you? And what should we in the United States be looking out for? Professor?
What I'm most worried about is what the outcome of these negotiations going on at the moment between the British government and the EU, Sefcovic. The outcome of these talks, I think, will be very important. So the protocol is the mechanism that's been put in place to ensure that there isn't a hard border on the island of Ireland. But the EU does have to protect its borders. So if that goes, something will have to replace it. The general behaviour of Boris Johnson is so worrying on a number of fronts that I'm very concerned about what the fallout from the protocol would be and the extent to which he could go to have very negative relations with the EU, which would make everything very difficult for everyone on this island, for the Irish government and for any administration here. So I'm kind of hedging my bets on the future because I'm very worried about the immediate future and I want to see how that goes. I also don't think that it's a good idea of Sinn Féin in particular to press so heavily for a border referendum. I think coming from Sinn Féin, it's not going to get a very positive reception anyway. I agree with Susan that Sinn Féin need to think quite carefully about how unionists see them because, you know, they very much come over as wolves in sheep's clothing. If there were to be any hope of a new Ireland, one of the obstacles to it is possibly the contemporary attitude of Sinn Féin.
I agree that there's a lot of fear around, and I would share Margaret's anxiety about the behaviour of the current British government, because in the same way that political unionism in Northern Ireland has tried to use the threat of loyalist violence as a way of manoeuvring, I think the British government is using Northern Ireland as a way of creating a warlike relationship with the European Union. And that is problematic because it means that they don't care really what happens in Ireland, and that has been proved over and over again. So I think that, you know, provided the Republican movement does face up to its responsibilities for a lot of hurt within the unionist community and begins to sort of talk to the unionist community in a way that indicates that there will never be any going back to violence, which I don't believe there will, I think that there can be a good dialogue there. And I do think that there is a real prospect that we could have a new Ireland in which there can be negotiations towards equality and finally get rid of the notion, the vestiges of the two sectarian states.
Susan McKay is a journalist who covers the politics and culture of Northern Ireland. Her recent book is Northern Protestants on Shifting Ground. And Dr. Margaret O'Callaghan is a senior lecturer in modern Irish politics and history in the School of Anthropology, Philosophy, and Politics at Queen's University in Belfast. You've been listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED, with generous support from TPG, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and from listeners like you. If you want to support the program by becoming a member or making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. And we want to hear from you. What did you think of this episode? Do you have ideas for future programs? Email us back at feedback@worldaffairs.org. The episode was produced by Andrew Stelzer, Elise Manoukian, and Matteo Schimpf, with reporting from Don Duncan in Belfast. Jim Bennett is our technical supervisor. Our executive producer is Joanne Jennings. Philip Yun is CEO of World Affairs. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Ray Suarez. Thanks for joining us.